When he was left alone, he wandered over to the lectern and looked at the book. The title, in impressively flickering red letters, was the Maleficarum Sumpta Diabolicitae Ocularis Singularum, the Book of Ultimate Control. He knew about it. There was a copy in the library somewhere, although wizards never bothered with it. This might seem odd, because if there is one thing a wizard would trade his grandmother for, it is power. But it wasn't all that strange, because any wizard bright enough to survive for 5 minutes was also bright enough to realise that if there was any power in demonology, then it lay with the demons. Using it for your own purposes would be like trying to beat mice to death with a rattlesnake. Even wizards thought demonologists were odd. They tended to be surreptitious, pale men who got up to complicated things in darkened rooms and had damp, weak handshakes. It wasn't like good, clean magic. No self-respecting wizard would have any truck with the demonic regions, whose inhabitants were as big a collection of ding-dongs as you'd find outside a large belfry. He inspected the skeleton closely, just in case. It didn't seem inclined to make a contribution to the situation.
"It belonged to his what's-name, grandfather," said a cracked voice behind him.
"Bit of an unusual bequest," said Rincewind.
"Oh, not personally. It got in a shop somewhere. It's one of them articulate what's-names."
"It's not saying much right now," said Rincewind, and then went very quiet and thoughtful. He said, without moving his head. "What precisely am I talking to?"
"I'm a what's-name. Tip of me tongue. Begins with a P."
Rincewind turned around slowly. "You're a parrot," he said.
"That's it."
Rincewind stared at the thing on the perch. It had one eye that glittered like a ruby. Most of the rest of it was pink and purple skin, studded with the fag-ends of feathers, so that the net effect was of an oven-ready hairbrush. It jiggled arthritically on its perch, and then slowly lost its balance until it was hanging upside down.
"I thought you were stuffed," said Rincewind.
"Up yours, wizard!"
Rincewind ignored it and crept over to the window. It was small, but gave out onto a gently sloping roof. And out there was real life, real sky, real buildings. He reached out to open the shutters. A crackling current coursed up his arm and earthed itself in his cerebellum. He sat on the floor, sucking his fingers.
"He told you," said the parrot, swinging backwards and forwards, upside down. "But you wouldn't wasname. He's got you by the wasnames."
"But it should only work on demons."
"Ah,"
said the parrot, achieving enough momentum to swing upright again, whereupon it steadied itself with the stubby remains of what once had been wings.
"It's all according, innit? If you come in through a door marked wasnames, that means you get treated as a wasname, right? Demon, I mean. Subject to all the rules and wasnames. Tough one for you."
"But you know I'm a wizard, don't you?"
The parrot gave a squawk.
"I've seen 'em, mate. The real Mac wasname. Some of the ones we've had in here, they'd make you choke on your millet. Great, scaly, fiery wasnames. Took weeks to get the soot off the walls,"
it added, in an approving tone of voice.
"That was in his grandad's day, of course. The kid hasn't been any good at it, up to now. Bright lad. I blame the wasnames, parents. New money, you know, wine business. Spoil him rotten. Let him play with his wasnames' old stuff. Oh, he's such an intelligent lad. Knows always in the book,"
the parrot mimicked.
"They never give him any of the things a sensitively growing wasname really needs, if you was to ask me."
"What, you mean love and guidance?" said Rincewind.
"I was thinking of a bloody good wasname, thrashing," said the parrot.
Rincewind clutched at his aching head. If this was what demons usually had to go through, no wonder they were all so annoyed.
"Polly want a biscuit,"
said the parrot vaguely, in much the same way as a human would say, or as I was saying, and went on,
"His grandad was keen on it, that and his pigeons."
"Pigeons?" said Rincewind.
"Not that he was particularly successful. It was all a bit trial of wasname."
"I thought you said great big scaly—"
"Oh, yes. But that wasn't what he was after. He was trying to conjure up a succubus."
It should be impossible to leer when all you've got is a beak, but the parrot managed it.
"That's a female demon what comes in the night and makes mad, passionate wuss—"
"I've heard of them," said Rincewind. "Bloody dangerous things."
The parrot put its head on one side.
"It never worked. All he ever got was a neuralgia."
"What's that?"
"It's a demon that comes and has a headache at you."
Demons have existed on the Discworld for at least as long as the gods, who in many ways they closely resemble. The difference is basically the same as that between terrorists and freedom fighters. Most of the demons occupy a spacious dimension close to reality, traditionally decorated in shades of flame and maintained at roasting point.
This isn't actually necessary, but if there is one thing that your average demon is, it is a traditionalist. In the centre of the inferno, rising majestically from a lake of lava substitute, and with unparalleled views of the eight circles, lies the city of Pandemonium. Demons and their hell are quite different from the dungeon dimensions, those endless parallel wastelands outside space and time. The sad, mad things in the dungeon dimensions have no understanding of the world, but simply crave light and shape and try to warm themselves by the fires of reality, clustering around it with about the same effect if they broke through as an ocean trying to warm itself around a candle. Whereas demons belong to the same space-time wasname, more or less, as humans, and have a deep and abiding interest in humanity's day-to-day affairs. Interestingly enough, the gods of the disc have never bothered much about judging the souls of the dead, and so people only go to hell if that's where they believe, in their deepest heart, that they deserve to go, which they won't do if they don't know about it. This explains why it is important to shoot missionaries on sight. The city of Pandemonium. At the moment, it was living up to its name. Astfagul, the new king of the demons, was furious. Not simply because the air conditioning had broken down again, not because he felt surrounded by idiots and plotters on every side, and not even because no one could pronounce his name properly yet, but also because he had just been given bad news. The demon who had been chosen by lottery to deliver it cowered in front of his throne with its tail between its legs. It was immortally afraid that something wonderful was going to happen to it. Demons have a distorted sense of values.
"It did what?"
said Astfagul.
"It opened, O Lord, the circle in Pseudopolis."
"Ah, the clever boy. We have great hopes of him."
"Then it closed again, Lord."
The demon shut its eyes.
"And who went through?"
The demon looked around at its colleagues, clustered at the far end of the mile-long throne room.
"I said, and who went through?"
"In point of fact, O Lord."
"Yes?"
"We don't know. Someone."
"I gave orders, did I not, that when the boy succeeded, the Duke Fascinago was to materialize unto him and offer him forbidden pleasures and dark delights to bend him to our will?"
The king growled. The problem with being evil, he'd been forced to admit, was that demons were not great innovatory thinkers, and really needed the spice of human ingenuity. And he'd really been looking forward to Eric Thursley, whose brand of superintelligent gormlessness was a rare delight. Hell needed horribly bright, self-centred people like Eric. They were much better at being nasty than demons could ever manage.
"Indeed, Lord," said the demon, "and the Duke has been awaiting the summons there for years, shunning all other temptations, steadfastly and patiently studying the world of men."
"So where was he?"
"Call of supernature, Lord," the demon gabbled. "Hadn't turned his back for 2 minutes when—"
"And someone went through?"
"We're trying to find out."
Lord Astfagul's patience, which in any case had the tensile strength of putty, snapped at this point. That just about summed it up. He had the kind of subjects who used the words "find out" when they meant ascertain. Damnation was too good for them.
"Get out," he whispered, "and I shall see to it that you get a commendation for this."
"Oh, master, I plead—"
"Get out!"
The king stamped along the glowing corridors to his private apartments. His predecessors had favoured shaggy hind legs and hooves. Lord Astfagul had rejected all that sort of thing out of hand. He held that no one would ever get taken seriously by those stuck-up bastards in Dun Manifesting when their rear end kept ruminating all the time, and so he favoured a red silk cloak, crimson tights, a cowl with two rather sophisticated little horns on it, and a trident. The end kept dropping off the trident, but, he felt, it was the sort of get-up in which a demon king could be taken seriously. In the coolness of his chambers, oh, by all the gods, or rather, not by all the gods, it had taken him ages to get them up to some sort of civilized standard. His predecessors had been quite content just to lounge around and tempt people. They had never heard of executive stress. He gently lifted the cover of the Mirror of Souls and watched it flicker into life. Its cool, black surface was surrounded by an ornate frame from which curls of greasy smoke constantly unfolded and drifted.
"Your wish, master," it said.
"Show me the events around the Pseudopolis Gate over the last hour," said the king, and settled down to watch.
After a while, he went and looked up the name Rincewind in the filing cabinet he had recently had installed in place of the distressingly bound old ledgers that had been there. The system still needed ironing out, though, because the bewildered demons filed everything under P for people. Then he sat watching the flickering pictures and absent-mindedly playing with the stuff on his desk to soothe his nerves. He had any amount of desk things, notepads with magnets for paperclips, handy devices for holding pens, and those tiny jotters that always come in handy, incredibly funny statuettes with slogans like, "You're the boss," and little chromium balls and spirals operated by a sort of ersatz and short-lived perpetual motion. No one looking at that desk could have any doubt that they were, in cold fact, truly damned.
"I see," said Lord Astafagel,
setting a selection of shiny balls swinging with one tap of a talon. He couldn't remember any demon called Rincewind. On the other hand, there were millions of the wretched things swarming all over the place with no sense of order, and he hadn't yet had time to carry out a proper census and retire the unnecessary ones. This one seemed to have fewer appendages and more vowels in its name than most, but it had to be a demon. Vasanego was a proud old fool, one of the elder demons who smiled and despised him and not quite obeyed him, just because the king had worked hard over the millennia to get from humble beginnings to where he was today. He wouldn't put it past the old devil to do this on purpose, just to spite him. Well, he'd have to see about that later. Send him a memo or something. Too late to do anything about it now. He'd have to take a personal interest. Eric Thursley was too good a prospect to pass up. Getting Eric Thursley would really annoy the gods. Gods! How he hated the gods! He hated the gods even more than he hated the old guard like Vasanego, even more than he hated humans. He'd thrown a little soiree last week. He'd put a lot of thought into it. He wanted to show that he was prepared to let bygones be bygones, work with them for a new, better and more efficient universe. Eric peered around the door.
"What shape are you?" he said.
"Pretty poor shape," said Rincewind.
"I've brought you some food. You don't eat, do you?"
Rincewind tried some. It was a bowl of cereal, nuts and dried fruit. He didn't have a quarrel with any of that. It was just that somewhere in the preparation something had apparently been done to these innocent ingredients, what it takes a million gravities to do to a neutron star. If you died of eating this sort of thing, they wouldn't have to bury you. They would just need to drop you somewhere where the ground was soft. He managed to swallow it. It wasn't difficult. The trick would have been preventing it from heading downwards.
"Lovely," he choked.
The parrot did a splendid impersonation of someone being sick.
"I've decided to let you go," said Eric. "It's pretty pointless keeping you, isn't it?"
"Absolutely."
"You don't have any powers at all."
"Sorry, dead failure."
"You don't look too demonic, come to think of it," said Eric. "They never do. You can't trust them, what's-names," chortled the parrot.
It lost its balance again.
"Polly want a biscuit,"
it said, upside down. Rincewind spun round.
"You stay out of this, beaky."
There was a sound behind them, like the universe clearing its throat. The chalk marks of the magic circle grew terribly bright for a moment, became fiery lines against the scuffed planks, and something dropped out of the empty air and landed heavily on the floor. It was a large, metal-bound chest. It had fallen on its curved lid. After a while it started to rock violently. Then it extended hundreds of little pink legs and, with considerable effort, flipped itself over. Finally, it shuffled around until it was watching the pair of them. It was all the more disconcerting because it was staring without having any eyes to do it with. Eric moved first. He grasped the homemade magic sword, which flapped wildly.
"You are a demon," he said. "I nearly believed you when you said you weren't." "Whee!" said the parrot.
"It's just my luggage," said Rincewind desperately. "It's a sort of... well, it goes everywhere with me. There's nothing demonic about it. He hesitated. "Not much, anyway," he finished lamely.
"Avaunt!"
"Oh, not again." The boy looked at the open book.
"My commands earlier resume," he said firmly. the most beautiful woman who has ever lived, mastery of all the kingdoms of the world, and to live forever. Get on with it.'
Rincewind stood frozen.
"'Well, go on,' said Eric. "'You're supposed to disappear in a puff of smoke.'
"'Listen, do you think I can just snap my fingers?'
Rincewind snapped his fingers. There was a puff of smoke. Rincewind gave his fingers a long, shocked stare, as one might regard a gun that had been hanging on the wall for decades and has suddenly gone off and perforated the cat. "'They've hardly ever done that before,' he said. He looked down.
"'Ah!'
he said, and closed his eyes. It was a better world in the darkness behind his eyelids. If he tapped his foot, he could persuade himself that he could feel the floor. He could know that he was really standing in the room, and that the urgent signals from all his other senses, which were telling him that he was suspended in the air some 1,000 miles or so above the disk, were just a bad dream he'd wake up from. He hastily cancelled that thought. If he was asleep, he'd prefer to stay that way. You could fly in dreams. If he woke up, it was a long way to fall. Perhaps I have died, and I really am a demon, he thought. It was an interesting point. He opened his eyes again.
"'Wow!' said Eric, his eyes gleaming. "'Can I have all of it?'
The boy was standing in the same position as he had been in the room. So was the luggage. So, to Rincewind's annoyance, was the parrot. It was perching in mid-air, looking speculatively at the cosmic panorama below. The disk might almost have been designed to be seen from space. It hadn't, Rincewind was damn sure, been designed to be lived on. But he had to admit it was impressive. The sun was about to rise on the far rim and made a line of fire that glittered around half the circumference. A long, slow dawn was just beginning its sweep across the dark, massive landscape. Below, harshly lit in the arid vacuum of space, great Atuin, the world turtle, toiled under the weight of creation. On his, or her, the matter had never really been resolved, carapace, the four giant elephants strained to support the disk itself. There might have been more efficient ways to build a world. You might start with a ball of molten iron and then coat it with successive layers of rock, like an old-fashioned gobstopper, and you'd have a very efficient planet, but it wouldn't look so nice. Besides, things would drop off the bottom.
"'Pretty good,' said the parrot. "'Polly want a continent?' "'It's so big,' breathed Eric.
"'Yes,' said Rincewind flatly.
He felt that something more was expected of him.
"'Don't break it,' he added.
He had a nagging doubt about all this. If he was, for the sake of argument, a demon, and so many things had happened to him recently that he was prepared to concede that he might have died and not noticed it in the confusion. Rincewind had been told that death was just like going into another room. The difference is, when you shout, "'Where's my clean socks?' no one answers. If he'd died and not noticed it in the confusion, then he still didn't quite see how the world was his to give away. He was pretty sure that it had owners who felt the same way. Also, he was sure that a demon had to get something in writing.
"'I think you have to sign for it,' he said. "'In blood.'
"'Whose?'
said Eric.
"'Yours, I think,' said Rincewind. "'Or bird blood will do at a pinch?'
He glared meaningfully at the parrot, which growled at him.
"'Aren't I allowed to try it out first?
"'What?'
"'Well, supposing it doesn't work. "'I'm not signing for it until I've seen it work.'
Rincewind stared at the boy. Then he looked down at the broad panorama of the kingdoms of the world. "'I wonder if I was like him at his age,' he thought. "'I wonder how I survived.'
"'It's the world,' he said patiently. "'Of course it will bloody well work. "'I mean, look at it. "'Hurricanes, continental drift, rainfall cycle, it's all there. "'All ticking over like a bloody watch. "'It'll last you a lifetime, a world like that.' Used carefully.
Eric gave the world a critical examination. He wore the expression of someone who knows that all the best gifts in life seem to require the psychic equivalent of 2 U2 batteries, and the shops won't be open until after the holidays.
"'There's got to be tribute,' he said flatly.
"'You what?'
"'The kings of the world,' said Eric. "'They've got to pay me tribute.'
"'You've really been studying this, haven't you?' said Rincewind sarcastically. "'Just tribute?' You don't fancy the moon while we're up here. This week's special offer, one free satellite with every world dominated.
Are there any useful minerals?
What?
Eric gave a sigh of long-suffering patience.
Minerals, he said. Ores, you know.
Rincewind coloured.
I don't think a lad your age should be thinking of...
I mean metal and things. It's no use to me if it's just a load of rock.
Rincewind looked down.
The Discworld's tiny moonlet was just rising over the far edge and shed a pale radiance across the jigsaw pattern of land and sea.
"Oh, I don't know. It looks quite nice," he volunteered.
"Look, it's dark now. Perhaps everyone can pay you tribute in the morning." "I want some tribute now."
"I thought you might."
Rincewind gave his fingers a careful examination. It wasn't as if he'd ever been particularly good at snapping them. He gave it another try. When he opened his eyes again, he was standing up to his ankles in mud. Pre-eminent amongst Rincewind's talents was his skill in running away, which over the years he had elevated to the status of a genuinely pure science. It didn't matter if you were fleeing from or to, so long as you were fleeing. It was flight alone that counted. I run, therefore I am. More correctly, I run, therefore, with any luck, I'll still be. But he was also skilled in languages and in practical geography. He could shout help in 14 languages and scream for mercy in a further 12. He had passed through many of the countries on the disc, some of them at high speed, and during the long, lovely, boring hours when he'd worked in the library, he'd whiled away the time by reading up on all the exotic and faraway places he'd never visited. He remembered that at the time he'd sighed with relief that he'd never have to visit them. And now, here he was. Jungle surrounded him. It wasn't nice, interesting, open jungle, such as leopard-skin-clad heroes might swing through, but serious, real jungle. Jungle that towered up like solid slabs of greenness, thorned and barbed. Jungle in which every representative of the vegetable kingdom had really rolled up its bark and got down to the strenuous business of outgrowing all competitors. The soil was hardly soil at all, but dead plants on the way to composthood. Water dripped from leaf to leaf, insects whined in the humid, spore-laden air, and there was the terrible, breathless silence made by the motors of photosynthesis running flat out. Any yodeling hero who tried to swing through that lot might just as well take his chances with a bean slicer.
"How do you do that?" said Eric.
"It's probably a knack," said Rincewind.
Eric subjected the wonders of nature to a cursory and disdainful glance.
"This doesn't look like a kingdom," he complained. "You said we could go to a kingdom. Do you call this a kingdom?"
"This is probably the rainforests of Klatch," said Rincewind. "They're stuffed full of lost kingdoms."
"You mean mysterious ancient races of Amazonian princesses who subject all male prisoners to strange and exhaustive progenitative rites?"
said Eric, his glasses beginning to fog.
"Ha-ha," said Rincewind stonily. "What an imagination a child has."
"What's name, what's name, what's name?" shrieked the parrot. "I've read all about them," said Eric, peering into the greenery. "Of course, I own those kingdoms as well."
He stared at some private inner vision.
"Gosh!"
he said hungrily. "I should concentrate on the tribute if I was you," said Rincewind, setting off down what was possibly a path. The brightly coloured blooms on a tree nearby turned to watch him go. In the jungles of Central Klatch there are indeed lost kingdoms of mysterious Amazonian princesses who capture male explorers for specifically masculine duties. These are indeed rigorous and exhausting, and the luckless victims do not last long. This is because wiring plugs, putting up shelves, sorting out the funny noise in the attics, and mowing lawns can eventually reduce even the strongest constitution. There are also hidden plateau, where the reptilian monsters of a bygone epoch romp and play, as well as elephants' graveyards, lost diamond mines, and strange ruins decorated with hieroglyphs, the very sight of which can freeze the most valiant heart. On any reasonable map of the area, there's barely room for the trees. The few explorers who have returned have passed on a number of handy hints to those who follow after, such as 1. Avoid, if possible, any hanging down creepers with beady eyes and a forked tongue at one end. 2. Don't pick up any orange and black striped creepers that are apparently lying across the path twitching because there is often a tiger on the other end. And 3. Don't go.
"If I'm a demon," Rincewind thought hazily, "why is everything stinging me and trying to trip me up? I mean, surely I can only be harmed by a wooden dagger through my heart. Or do I mean garlic?"
Eventually the jungle opened out into a very wide, cleared area that stretched all the way to a distant blue range of volcanoes. The land fell away below them to a patchwork of lakes and swampy fields, here and there punctuated by great stepped pyramids, each one crowned with a thin plume of smoke curling into the dawn air. The jungle track opened out into a narrow but paved road.
"'Where's this, demon?'
said Eric. "'It looks like one of the Tezuman kingdoms,' said Rincewind. "'They're ruled over by the great Mazuma, I think.'
"'She's an Amazonian princess, is she?'
"'Strangely enough, no. "'You'd be astonished how many kingdoms aren't ruled by Amazonian princesses, Eric.'
"'It looks pretty primitive, anyway. A bit Stone Age.'
"'The Tezuman priests have a sophisticated calendar and an advanced horology,' quoted Rincewind.
"'Oh,' said Eric. "'Good.'
"'No,' said Rincewind patiently. "'It means time measurement.'
"'How?'
"'You'd approve of them. They're superb mathematicians, apparently.'
"'Ha!'
said Eric, blinking solemnly.
"'Shouldn't think they've got a lot to count in a backward civilization like this.'
Rincewind eyed the chariots that were heading rapidly towards them. "'I think they usually count victims,' he said. The Tezuman Empire in the jungle valleys of central Klatch is known for its organic market gardens, its exquisite craftsmanship in obsidian, feathers and jade, and its mass human sacrifices in honour of Quez Over Coatl, the feathered boa, god of mass human sacrifices. As they said, you always knew where you stood with Quez Over Coatl. It was generally with a lot of people on top of a great stepped pyramid with someone in an elegant feathered headdress chipping an exquisite obsidian knife for your very own personal use. The Tezuman are renowned on the continent for being the most suicidally gloomy, irritable and pessimistic people you could ever hope to meet, for reasons that may soon be made clear. It was true about the time measurement as well. The Tezuman had realised long ago that everything was getting steadily worse, and, having a terrible literal-mindedness, had developed a complex system to keep track of how much worse each succeeding day was. Contrary to general belief, the Tezuman did invent the wheel. They just had radically different ideas about what you used it for. It was the first chariot Rincewind had ever seen that was pulled by llamas. That wasn't what was odd about it. What was odd about it was that it was being carried by people, two holding each side of the axle and running after the animals, their sandaled feet flapping on the flagstones.
"'Do you think it's got the tribute in it?'
said Eric. All the leading chariot seemed to contain, apart from the driver, was a squat, basically cube-shaped man, wearing a puma-skin outfit and a feather headdress. The runners panted to a halt, and Rincewind saw that each man wore what would probably be described as a primitive sword, made by affixing shards of obsidian into a wooden club. They looked to him no less deadly than sophisticated, extremely civilized swords. In fact, they looked worse.
"'Well?'
said Eric. "'Well, what?' said Rincewind.
"'Tell him to give me my tribute.'
The fat man got down ponderously, marched over to Eric, and to Rincewind's extreme surprise, grovelled. Rincewind felt something claw its way up his back and onto his shoulder, when a voice like a sheet of metal being torn in half said,
"'That's better. Very wasname, Comfy. If you try to knock me off, demon, you can wasname your ear goodbye. What a turn-up for the scrolls, eh? They seem to be expecting him.'
"'Why do you keep saying wasname?' said Rincewind.
"'Limited wasname, doodah, thingy, you know. It's got words in it,'
said the parrot. "'Dictionary?' said Rincewind. The passengers in the other chariots had got out and were also grovelling to Eric, who was beaming like an idiot. The parrot considered this.
"'Yeah, probably,' it said. "'I've got to wing it to you,' it went on. "'I thought you were a bit of a wasname at the start, but you seem to be delivering the wasname.' "'Demon,'
said Eric airily. "'Yes?'
"'What are they saying? Can't you speak their language?'
"'No,' said Rincewind. "'I can read it, though,' he called out, as Eric turned away. "'If you could just sort of make signs for them to write it down.'